This is Radio Boston. I'm Yasmin Ammer, in for Tiziana Deering. Today, we start in Cohasset. But beforehand, just a quick warning to our listeners. The content of today's conversation might be difficult for some listeners. It includes references to murder and domestic violence. The case of Anna Walsh has dominated headlines for the last 3 weeks. So let's get you caught up.
The search for the Cohasset mother of three remains close to where she was last seen early New Year's Day. The 39-year-old has been missing for almost a week.
Anna was reported missing by her employer on January 4th. 4 days later, her husband was arrested.
The 46-year-old husband of Anna Walsh was brought into custody by police. He's charged with misleading a police investigation.
Police continued their investigation.
This morning, it appears that investigators have concluded their search of the property of Brian and Anna Walsh. There is still no sign of the missing mother of three. Her husband remains behind bars.
And this week, there was a new development.
Her husband, Brian Walsh, is charged with her murder.
All that sound is from WCVB. We do want to note to our listeners that Brian Walsh has been charged with murder, not convicted. We are going to discuss domestic violence and intimate partner homicide a little later in the segment, but we want to start today's conversation with some of the legal questions surrounding this case. So we have Michelle Cruz here with us. She is a Massachusetts-based attorney with more than 20 years of litigation experience in civil rights, criminal law, and victims' rights and family law. Thank you so much, Michelle, for being with us.
Thank you, Yasmin, for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this very disturbing case.
Yeah, and disturbing indeed. This story has had a lot of twists and turns. And I want to know if you were surprised that Anna Walsh's husband was charged with her murder.
I can't say I was surprised. I was definitely relieved that they acted quickly and pretty impressed with the level of investigation that has taken place so far.
Mm, and again, I'm going to keep repeating this. He is charged and not convicted. So all of this is alleged murder. So as of this morning, Anna's body has not been found. Is it common for a murder charge to be given if there's no body?
So I would say that it's not common, but it has occurred before. And it makes obviously for a difficult case. But there's pretty, from what I've seen so far and based on the information available, it seems like there's a pretty strong circumstantial case here with a lot of physical evidence pointing in one direction.
Mm, and I want to put a pin in that because I'm going to ask more questions about that later. But while there is no body, Norfolk prosecutor Lynn Beelin presented some Google searches allegedly made by Brian Walsh during his arraignment this week. I want to again highlight to some listeners that the sound here might be disturbing.
At 4:55 a.m. on January 1st, he searched how long before a body starts to smell. At 4:58 a.m., how to stop a body from decomposing. At 5:20 a.m., he searched how to embalm a body.
That sound is from WCVB. So can a Google search be submitted as evidence?
With regards to Google searches, you can enter that into evidence. It's not for the truth of the matter asserted because that's hearsay, obviously, but it's to show information that was requested off of Google. And the content and the search obviously are concerning facts that that the prosecutor has uncovered. So you can, they're going to have a little bit of a difficult time with authentication, how to show that it came from, you know, that particular device. There's going to probably have to be search warrants to the search engines and IP information. So it's a technical case, but it can be brought into court.
I'm curious if there are other pieces of evidence that you're thinking about and looking at that go beyond the Google searches or the missing body.
So I think with this case, the information that I've seen that's available to the public, and as you know, this investigation doesn't stop once there's an arrest, it continues. But the information available so far to the public includes information such as the defendant gave certain statements about his whereabouts when questioned by the police. And kind of overlaying that is also he requested windows because he was on house arrest, if you recall, to go to certain events like dropping off the kids or going to his mother's house. But it turns out that some of that information wasn't accurate. My understanding is the kids actually didn't have school on January 2nd. So he wasn't dropping them off. And, you know, that's concerning information. But he gave a timeline of where he was and the things he was doing. One of those timelines includes he went to his mother's house, then he went to Home Depot, Whole Foods, and then CVS, when in fact he was later seen on video, or what they believed to be him on video, at Home Depot buying certain items, including, he was buying, I believe,
$450 worth of cleaning supplies.
Correct. And some of the places he said he was, he actually was confirmed not to be there, but to be in other venues. And so that storyline is going to be a huge part of this circumstantial case. The other pieces are the DNA. My understanding is they looked through a trash pile in Peabody, and they found a rug. They found a Cybex suit, a hacksaw, and other items. And then they were able to uncover some DNA on at least the Tyvek suit and the rug, I believe, that matched both Anna and the defendant. So that information is hard to kind of maneuver around because there was an absolutely different timeline presented to the police when initially questioned. And those pieces of hard DNA are really going to be difficult for the defendant to contend with. There's definitely some very interesting pieces of evidence. I believe there's also a bloody slipper found that had her DNA and his DNA on it.
Do you think more charges could be filed against Brian Walsh?
There could be more charges. I think that the charges presently are based on just what I'm seeing, appropriate based on the circumstances. When you look back at the history of these parties, there was a threatening call back in, I think it's 2014, where Anna had called the police about her, at the time, boyfriend, that the D.C. Law enforcement has confirmed was, I believe, Mr. Walsh. And there was also, I understand, some fight over where the children were going to live, as Anna, I believe, was living part-time in D.C. because of her work.
Yeah.
And Mr. Walsh was on house arrest up here in Massachusetts. So it sounds like there was a lot of tension. And, you know, I don't know the entire history, but it sounds like, with that one call to the police in 2014, that there's some domestic violence present in this case. And probably, as we learn more from Anna's, circle, that I think we're going to learn more about the inside of that home. And
it's
what was
it's
going
no
on.
Doubt such a huge part of this conversation. But thank you so much, Michelle Cruz. And that's Massachusetts-based attorney Michelle Cruz, and she has more than 20 years of litigation experience in civil rights. Thank you for joining us, Michelle. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, this case has dominated headlines in the Commonwealth, throughout the nation. And I want to shift now to talk about how this case is being portrayed. So I'm bringing in Northeastern University Assistant Teaching Professor and in the program in Media and Screen Studies, Laurel Onert. And so, Laurel, it's so nice to have you on the show again. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You heard what Michelle and I were talking about, just outlining the story. What has struck you the most as you watched the story unfold in the media?
Well, I think what's most notable here in cases like this is that it's real-time coverage of an ongoing event as it unfolds in time. There's a lot more facts to come, I'm sure, as the investigation continues. And so what we see is two parallel tracks emerging, right? The arraignment has happened. We imagine that there might be a trial coming. That we have the court case and then the court of public opinion emerging. These two parallel tracks that are connected as media covers these events as they're investigated. But with the court case, the outcome is about justice. It involves an adversarial system where a prosecutor lays out the facts and a defense attorney makes a rebuttal. But that same kind of adversarial system doesn't happen in media coverage. Media coverage is about telling a story to inform, to entertain. And so there is a different set of norms and outcomes. And so I think that's important to keep in mind, not to, you know, defend Brian Walsh in this case or anything, but to just encourage us to be savvy media consumers and understand
the
distinction.
Because we don't know if he did it. Like, he hasn't been convicted again. But, I mean, just a really basic question. Do you think the media is doing a good job?
Oh, that's a hard question to answer. I think that the media could potentially be informed by some of the trend in true crime podcasts, like My Favorite Murder and other types of podcasts that take a very particular feminist approach to coverage, where they center the voices of women, they give victims and survivors space to tell their own stories, and pay attention to the life and achievements of the victim as opposed to the gruesome details and circumstances of their death.
So just why do you think these cases capture, why do you think Anna Walsh's case has captured attention?
I think we tend to pay more attention to victims with socially desirable attributes. They tend to be young and attractive women, people who are more middle class or affluent, who are seen as the ideal sympathetic victim. And that's not to take away from the tragedy of what we imagine happened to Anna, but to acknowledge that those who deviate from these ideal norms are often denied recognition as victims. They're not seen as deserving of public attention and protection. The Black and Missing Foundation did research, and they found that 40% of missing persons cases involve people of color, but only 13% of those cases are covered in media.
And I know there have been more efforts to draw attention to that coverage, but it's still not nearly enough, we're seeing, obviously. So thank you so much. We've been speaking with Laurel Onert, a Northeastern University assistant teaching professor in the program in Media and Screen Studies. Stick with us right now. We still have a lot of legal questions and ethical questions coming up in this case, but I want to shift. Because this week, Brian Walsh, Anna's husband, was formally charged with her murder. And so we want to note that the investigation is still ongoing. He has not been convicted. But an important part of this conversation in a case like this is domestic violence homicide. These incidents are not uncommon in Massachusetts. According to a recent report from the State Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team, there were 15 domestic violence homicide victims in 2021. In the studio with us also is Sue Chandler, executive director of Dove. She's here with us. And her organization in Norfolk County, it's a nonprofit that's provided services for survivors of domestic violence since 1978. Sue, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Yasmin and WBOR, for covering this very important story.
And so tell me first, like, what is striking to you about this case?
I think I would echo what Laurel just commented on about the disparities in the way some of these cases are covered based on who the victim is in the story. What's striking is maybe some of the commonalities in what we know in these situations is when people, neighbors, friends say, "But he was charming. He was great. We knew him. This is stunning." That is very common to hear.
The initial pearl clutching of, like, how could he ever do this?
Yes.
And so could you tell me about some of the signs, some of the red flags that indicate someone may be suffering from domestic violence, and maybe focus on some signs that people aren't as quick to pick up on?
Yeah. I think there's a couple different angles on this. One is thinking about what might be happening for somebody in a situation. They may have some sort of gut feelings or spidey sense that something is off, but that sort of justify it or make excuses. But we encourage folks to listen to that. Sometimes at the beginning of a relationship, somebody might be just so incredibly attentive, again, charming, doing favors for somebody, and a feeling of, wow, this is just too good to be true. That might be happening. Where they're saying, I would love to know where you're going to be, who you're going to be with, because I'm worried about you. I just want to make sure for your safety. So paying attention to those things. And then, as I said, there may or may not be a gut feeling that something is normal or off. And for friends and family, thinking about what are you noticing? Isolation is incredibly common, a strategy of people who use abuse to isolate the victim from friends, family, coworkers. And so, you know, things like, I just want to have you all to myself this weekend. Can we not go watch the game at your sister's house? Or do we have to do this? Let's just hang together. That kind of stuff.
It sounds caring, but it's really it's isolating you and making you easier maybe to manipulate. But you know, we do want to mention domestic violence happens across genders and social classes, and I do want to ask you that if I suspect someone is struggling with domestic violence, it's a hairy situation for a bystander, a friend. Where do you even begin in calling that out? And should you always call it out? I mean, what do you do?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's really, really important. I think depending on if it's somebody if you know well or maybe less well, like a neighbor or a coworker, we would encourage folks to become knowledgeable themselves. And first and foremost, to do some self-care. Figure out how are you going to manage your own anxiety about this. It's very important to stay connected to the person and not do anything that's going to increase the isolation. So you might very gently, you know, first, a lot of people don't identify with the term domestic violence, the label domestic violence. So don't necessarily approach with that right up front, but maybe saying something like, you know, I've noticed this. I'm a little concerned. How are you feeling about it? We'd really love to see you. I understand you maybe want to stay home for the weekend, but we hope that maybe could we make a plan during the week? Can we walk the dogs together? Can we talk on whatever day? Don't trash talk the person using the abusive behaviors, because that's just going to cause the victim to become defensive, and yes, all the attention and energy goes there. Help them stay sort of grounded and normalize their life. Maybe inquiring, not blaming, but things like, how do you think this might be impacting the children? I really care about you. I'm concerned. I would really love to be a resource and help. If you'd like to use my computer, use my phone, for somebody maybe who's you're less connected to, giving them a safe link, little business card or a phone, you know, scrap of paper with a phone number and the safe link state hotline on it to say, this may or may not be happening for you, but in case it is.
And that phone number is 877-785-2020. We'll include it on our website, wbur.org. And I also want to mention another resource, Sue, while you're here, the 10 to 10 helpline, anonymous, free, confidential. And that serves Massachusetts adults and teens, 877-898-3411.
And that is a helpline for people who may recognize in themselves that they are using behaviors that we would consider coercive, abusive, that are problematic. It's a place now called a call to change helpline, but to reach out and use somebody as a sounding board to think about how you can stop using these behaviors.
We've been speaking with Sue Chandler, the executive director of Dove, a Norfolk County-based nonprofit that has provided services for survivors of domestic violence since 1978. A new investigation by ProPublica has found that at a handful of institutions, including Harvard University, hold thousands of remains of Native American ancestors. At Harvard alone, there are more than 1,000 individual remains. So joining us on the line is one of the reporters that worked on the project, ProPublica's Mary Huditz. She's also a past president of the Native American Journalists Association. Mary, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
One of the most striking things about this story, and I was captivated by it, is that right at the top, you talk about the fact that in 1990, Congress already passed a law, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, and that was more than 30 years ago. But tribes still have a really difficult time reclaiming those ancestral remains.
Yes, that was, I feel like, the sort of guiding question for a lot of our investigation is why, after 30 years, when Congress issued a call for institutions to review what they had and begin to return it to tribes, that so many institutions still have so much. In fact, looking at all of the more than 600 institutions that have to comply with the law, fewer than half of the human remains they had held or ancestral remains of Native Americans have been returned.
And so just correct me if I'm wrong, but only 10 institutions, including Harvard, they hold about half of the remains that have not been returned to tribes.
That is correct.
So let's talk about some of those obstacles facing a tribe attempting to reclaim ancestral remains. Like, what are they? What happens?
We hear a range of things that or arguments that tribes have encountered. One is that repatriation is complicated or expensive. It's expensive certainly for tribes who have to travel to an institution that might be fought, like, across the country from where they are. But institutions, even those with large budgets, will say that it's very expensive and takes a lot of time and resources. Beyond that, we start to see tribes will say that they are challenged on their actual claims to their ancestors. They may have stories of, you know, that have been passed down through generations or traditions, or even items that they use that are very similar to those that the institution holds. And an institution will say that maybe they, despite the evidence the tribe is presenting, they just don't have enough to show that their ancestors are who they say they are. So that can be where a lot of the anguish of this issue starts to come in, because it goes to identity and understanding of where your people are from.
So to build on that, one thing you had in your article that was really interesting is this idea of culturally identifiable, which is something that a lot of institutions use as kind of a defense to not return those remains, because they call them culturally culturally unidentifiable. What is that, and has that worked?
Yeah, culturally unidentifiable is something many museums cast their whole collections virtually as culturally unidentifiable, despite knowing where the excavation happened and then knowing that tribes had a claim to that region, either in the present day or historically. Culturally identifiable has actually started to be seen as so problematic that in new regulations that the Interior Department is proposing, they are basically proposing to do away with the term in the regulations and the law altogether. A lot of tribes find it offensive because they feel that they know who they are and they know where they come from. And to say that an ancestor is unidentifiable, I think, sort of takes away...
It kind of feels like a brazen denial of history, of your own history.
Yes, I think many people feel that way, yeah.
Mm. And I should note that we did reach out to Harvard for response. We did not get one. But I'd like to bring in another voice here. That's Jean-Luc Pierrette, and he is the president of the North American Indian Center of Boston. Jean-Luc, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So I'd love to hear reactions to what you've heard so far.
Yes. So these stories actually mean a great deal to me because I'm a member of the Tunica-Biloxi tribe of Louisiana. And just as some of the background to the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, some of the legislative history and background to that actual law, some of the foundations of that is kind of the story of the repatriation of what was called the largest cache of Indian trade goods back to my own tribe, which was called the Tunica Treasure, which was leased to the Harvard Peabody Museum. But our story is not necessarily special or unique beyond sort of that history. What this is kind of a similar situation for many tribes in which either battlefields were plundered or ancestral villages were excavated to sort of like the ambitions of fortunes of grave robbers, because there's actually a market for sacred objects and human remains. So there's issues beyond the institutions actually having these within collections. And there's also, you know, a couple of gaps. Even within the ProPublica data, we still have lots of qualifications because this is institutions that are self-reporting. These are institutions that receive federal funds, and so there are still many unknown institutions which have not reported or have not receive federal funds yet are publicly funded, and may also have a remain. So while it is an immense problem to think over 100,000 remains are within institutions, it's my sense that this is only the tip of the iceberg.
And although this might sound like an obvious question, but I want to make sure we recognize the weight of what we're talking about. What does it mean to a tribe when remains are successfully reclaimed?
My grandfather and his generation that actually fought for state recognition and federal recognition, this is the proof that we are who we say we are. And there are so many tribes that are affected that are not recognized or state recognized. They're still trying to assert themselves as the living descendants. And so this is all of who we are. And, you know, just to kind of like build off the idea of what is culturally identifiable or non-culturally identifiable, even if you say, for instance, that remains are from Choctaw peoples, well, it doesn't necessarily say, you know, what is the specific band or what is the specific tribal government that institutions should be working with for repatriation. So it really is impacting the ability of tribes for self-governance and sovereignty. So, you know, these are some of the things that we're really dealing with.
Mm. And take us behind the scenes a little bit, because I am curious what happens once remains are returned. And I mean, there's so many tribes and so much diversity among them. And I'm wondering if they're in agreement more or less about what happens when remains are returned.
Yes. And, you know, I mean, in a general sense, there could be situations in which, let's say, for instance, because we're talking about human remains and funerary objects, you know, in the case of human remains, tribes do need that opportunity to actually have ceremony and bury ancestors within homelands. But there are also times in which funerary objects have been out of the tribe's possession or out of the earth for so long that they have kind of lost their spirit. And so there are even times when tribes will kind of say, thank you, but, you know, this is something that is kind of lost its connection. Mm-hmm. So there are some really sensitive timing issues when it comes to human remains and funerary objects, but it absolutely takes years for you know, these items and remains to go from institutions back into the tribes of origin.
So as we mentioned, WBUR and ProPublica, we had a hard time getting a hold of Harvard to get the response on this. But I'm curious if you happen to have conversations with the university about this.
We have not had conversations with the actual university. However, we do have students that are community members of North American Indian Center of Boston. We have had stories related to, for instance, the hair samples that were announced at the end of last year. Originally, the Harvard Peabody Museum actually listed the names of the children that the hair samples were taken from these U.S.-based Indian boarding schools, and it was from that instance in which a student was actually able to alert their own tribal government, their tribal historic preservation officer, that there is a need to do a repatriation. Since then, Harvard has kind of obfuscated some of the data, saying, you know, this is, you know, these are sort of like the cultures, not necessarily the tribal governments, in which the remains that need to go back to. So there's still, you know, even within sort of like this awareness that we're doing, that we're receiving from such sources as the ProPublica data, and then even announcements by the institutions themselves, there's still some reading between the lines that need to happen. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's informing tribal citizens to go back to their governments and making sure that repatriation does happen.
And I do want to say the Peabody Museum, that's Harvard affiliated, has published a 2021 letter of apology. But Mary, I want to bring you back in this conversation. So reactions to anything you heard from John Luke?
Yeah, he brings up many excellent points. One of them is the reminder that tribes will have different preferences of how the process should go. And so that's a really good note. I think if I recall, you asked a question about maybe different claims to the same ancestors among tribes. And I feel that is something that happens maybe less than institutions suggest it does. We have started to see, because institutions felt like, oh, well, maybe many tribes have claims to one specific geographic point where remains had been excavated from. And a lot of times now what we see is that tribes have band together and created like common committees representing, say, a dozen tribes, so that they can start to get their ancestors home that way and not feel that institutions are dividing them.
Mm. And Mary, I couldn't help but wonder, could this lead to other types of reclamation efforts down the road, beyond remains, to maybe include belongings that were initially stolen, maybe even like nationally, internationally? This could kind of follow a pattern of people, groups of people, tribes reclaiming their stuff.
Yeah, NAGPRA is often described by people who are very much for repatriation as really the floor. And not the limit to where repatriation can go and those discussions can be. So, and ancestral remains are really what is the law sort of is able to provide data for in a little bit more of a cemented way. But yes, there's a lot of international discussion right now about reclaiming ancestors and items. And Congress even just passed a law now that I think offers tribes a little more protection sacred objects are taken to another country. So there's a lot happening in this space.
That's Mary Huditz, ProPublica reporter and a past president of the Native American Journalists Association. Thank you so much, Mary. And also Jean-Luc Pierrit. He's the president of the North American Indian Center of Boston. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. We're going to talk about housing. I'm Yasmeen Ammer, and this is Radio Boston.
High housing costs are unacceptable for our people, our businesses, and our state's future. To fix that, we need to think big.
That was Governor Maura Healey, minutes after she was sworn into office earlier this month. The new governor has made solving Massachusetts' housing crisis a big part of her agenda. So now that she's in office, what exactly is she planning to do? WBUR reporter Simone Rios has been digging into Healey's proposals, and he's here with us now. Hi, Simone.
Hey, Yasmin. Good to be here.
There's nothing more I love than talking about housing with you, so I'm glad you're here.
I'm glad you're here.
And also here is Joe Kreisberg, CEO of the think tank Mass Inc. Joe, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Okay, let's start with Simone. We're going to dive into the policy here, mm-hmm. but I want to start with some personal experiences because that is the most important part of yes. our housing crisis. So yes. one of our producers spoke to Dira Barbosa of Dorchester, who took the unusual step of buying a home with a friend.
I checked off everything on the list that you're supposed to do to prepare yourself for home ownership, but the reality is I could not afford it. So then I had to think of an alternative method of home ownership.
I mean, so getting creative because it's just bad. Mm. I mean, it's like you call it creative, but at the same time, it's just response to a crisis. We also spoke to Vanessa Vella. She's a veterinary technician who lives in Somerville.
The immigrant community has been pushed out of the cities like Somerville, Cambridge, and East Boston.
So, Simone, I'm guessing yes. some of this sounds familiar.
Yeah, I know Vanessa, actually. I interviewed her when the new Green Line stops open in her neighborhood in Somerville. You know, we've become a tale of two cities, two greater Bostons. You know, the people who can afford to live here and the people who are hanging on, you know, by the string of their teeth. The truth is that to lead a successful life in this region anywhere, people need stable housing. Whether that's through home ownership or through rental and or subsidized housing, you know, that allows people to plant roots in the neighborhoods. And I think the one thing that everybody can agree on is that the state is facing a massive housing shortage. So now the question is, with a new governor, what's going to happen on the housing front?
So I'd love to hear maybe some of your answers to that question, mm-hmm. because what are you hearing from Healey's team about their priorities?
Yeah, look, it's early days. This is the beginning of week three for the Healey administration. But, you know, they're looking to make housing a top priority. So there are several broad ideas, I'll say, on housing, like using underutilized state land to create more housing, and more broadly, fixing the racial home ownership gap. We don't have specific legislation at this point. That's because the first real step of the administration is to create a new cabinet-level housing secretary. So now housing is combined with economic and community development offices, and Healey's planning to elevate housing to the same level as, you know, transportation and climate. And actually happening today, the governor is going to be creating a working group that will determine how this housing office is structured, what its budget will be, et cetera. Then in a few months, we could see a state housing chief named. I actually sat down with the Lieutenant Governor, Kim Driscoll, earlier this week. She said the new secretary will have to create a roadmap for solving the state's housing needs.
We are 200,000 units housing short by most estimates for meeting the needs of the people who currently live here. So when we think about a housing roadmap, it certainly is having somebody in state government who is responsible for ensuring that we are doing all that we can to create more housing, to preserve existing housing, to make sure the housing that is produced, that a lot more of it's affordable and meeting community housing needs.
At the end of the day, Yasmin, this governor is going to need to play ball with the legislature, and that's easier said than done.
Oh, good grief. 200,000 units, and even yeah. I think that's probably on the conservative side. Right. So what are some of the housing advocates calling for? What are some of the wish lists that are just so obvious at this point? Like, what do they want?
Yeah, well, as you know, today's the filing deadline on Beacon Hill, and we're expecting to see several pieces of housing-related legislation. One is a tenant's right to counsel in housing court. You know, the vast majority of landlords have attorneys by their side when they're in housing court, and the vast minority of renters do not. Another bill looks to add more revenue for housing through real estate transfers. And another seeks to seal eviction records so that renters don't face discrimination on the basis of an eviction on their record.
Mm. So, excuse me. So, Joe, I want to bring you in. Where do you see the difference between what Governor Charlie Baker has done on housing and what Healey says she wants to do? Because we don't know yet.
Well, it's a great question, and I think you're going to see a lot of things continue. I mean, the governor has made that clear, that she supports many of the policies that Governor Baker put forward, most prominently changes to our zoning laws and the so-called MBTA zoning law that requires the 175 municipalities in the region to zone for multifamily housing. That was enacted by the legislature and signed by Governor Baker, but, you know, happily, Governor Healey's all in on that. And so I think we'll see that continue. Where I think you might see some change is more aggressive policy around the connection between housing and climate change. We need to greatly accelerate the rate at which we decarbonize our housing stock, and we have a very old housing stock that's going to be hard to do. And we didn't make as much progress on that in the last few years as we need to. And I think the issue of tenant protections, and Simone mentioned a couple of the bills there, some of those things actually were vetoed by Governor Baker, and I think there's hope that Governor Healey will support those or support a version of those so that tenants have more protections.
So I do want to know your thoughts, because you mentioned the requirement that communities should build more housing, need to build more multifamily housing near MBTA transit stops. Baker's administration has implemented that, but like towards the end of his tenure, he backed off of like the stick portion of it. He according to the Boston Globe, didn't threaten budgets of municipalities that don't comply. He just pulled back a little bit. But I say that to ask you this: how do you think the Baker administration did on housing?
Well, I think the Baker administration did a good job. I mean, we didn't have zoning reform for decades. So, you know, getting housing choices passed to make it easier to improve zoning and getting the MBTA communities bill passed were great steps forward. And they did happen late in his term. And so they couldn't be fully implemented while he was there. You know, I think where I would have liked to have seen Governor Baker do more is with the existing housing stock. You know, most of us live in housing that already exists, and most of us will continue to live in that housing for the next many decades. The house I live in is 100 years old. So what are we doing to make sure that housing is safe, it's healthy, it doesn't have lead paint? What are we doing to make sure that it can resist or be resilient as the climate changes? And how do we make sure that people who live there can stay where they want to live in the communities where they want to live and avoid displacement? So that was – the governor was so focused on new production that I think the existing stock didn't get enough attention. And I think what I'm hoping for the Healey administration is they can focus on both of those things.
So just to bring back to the conversation that we're having with Simone Rios, WBUR reporter, and Joe Kreisberg, the CEO of Mass Inc., about housing, I want to bring in again this the resident, Vanessa Vella, who we heard from earlier, the vet tech in Somerville.
We need to bring back rent control, because that it's the only way that the renters and the working community can feel a little more safe.
Simone, this we found this out this week, but Boston Mayor Michelle Wu has been floating a rent control proposal for the city, but she would need approval from the state to make anything happen.
Right.
Where does Healey stand on rent control?
Right. So just for some context, the mayor announced that she wants to see a 10% rent increase cap, right? Which is a lot higher of a number than a lot of housing advocates wanted to see. And then, you know, developers are going to oppose any, landlords are going to most likely oppose any kind of rent control. But keep in mind, rent control is banned in Massachusetts for almost 30 years. So for Boston, again, rent control, it would require lawmakers to create an exemption to the statewide ban. During her campaign, Governor Healey expressed openness to, you know, they're calling it rent stabilization, without a lot of specifics. But as for Boston's plan, I ran it by the lieutenant governor the other day, and she hadn't seen the proposal. But the sense I got was that the administration could be more open to local rent stabilization initiatives as opposed to a statewide policy like lifting the ban. But I think it'll really come down to what those local rent stabilization proposals look like.
Yeah, and I want to tell you that Mayor Wu will be on the show on Monday, and you bet we're going to ask her about rent control. So definitely tune in.
Yeah, Joe Kreisberg here actually sat on the committee that ultimately helped come up with this policy, right, Joe?
Yeah, I was on the mayor's rent stabilization committee.
And so what were some of the behind the scenes discussions that, I mean, was it rent, we need rent control now, or was there some back and forth about whether or not it's a good idea?
Well, it was a diverse committee, and I think people had different views. I think one of the things that we talked quite a bit about is the circumstance where a new owner comes in and buys a building, often from out of state, often from out of the country. And, tries to evict all the tenants, rehab the building, and significantly increase rents, 50, 75%. We heard a lot of stories like that. And I think that's what the mayor is trying to get at with this policy, but allowing enough of an annual rent increase that it doesn't disrupt the market too much. And I think that's the needle that the mayor is trying to thread. But it's a very small needle, and it's going to be difficult to get through both city council and the state legislature.
Oh, it's a delicate balance, and I do not envy her. But I want to bring in one more cut from Dira Barbosa, the Dorchester resident who bought a home with her friend, Saranya. She says the housing market feels caught up with race, too.
There are many of people who probably want to own. And I'm a woman of color, right? So, and I think that there's an equity issue when it comes to black and brown home ownership. I think for me, I would want to see that gap closed.
And so, I mean, that is something that you've reported on so much, Simone, was this gap in ownership. And really, housing is so, it's not even metaphorical. It's just like an in-your-face issue when it comes to discussing the wealth gap.
Yeah, for sure. It's everything. I mean, that's what gives white families their generational wealth. Mm-hmm. And that's what doesn't give so many black families, Latino families, any generational wealth, is not having home ownership. But, you know, I think this is really a conversation about something that has to take place in the suburbs, you know, because it takes years to build any kind of affordable housing. And if the suburbs aren't going to get on board with the statewide push to develop more housing, it's hard to see this new administration moving the needle as much as it needs to. You know, they need to contend with the legislature and the communities where we need more housing. And again, easier said than done.
Joe, you want to say something on this?
Yeah, this is a place where I think Governor Baker really did something important in his second term. You know, we met with him early on and we talked about the book, The Color of Law, which documents the history of housing segregation in this country and its impact on black and brown families. And he turned around and invested hundreds of millions of dollars in home ownership opportunities specifically to close the racial home ownership gap. We need to continue and expand those efforts. And it really speaks to, when we're talking about rent control and home ownership, that the most important word in housing policy is and. We need new housing and we need to rehab existing housing. We need rental housing, we need home ownership housing. We have to have a comprehensive approach for a complicated problem. There's no one solution.
Like, we are just so behind that just give us all of it, just as much as you can. Joe Kreisberg, CEO of the think tank Mass Inc., thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And as always, WBUR reporter Simone Rios, I really appreciate you.
Thanks, Yasmin. I had fun.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Yasmin Ammer, in for Tiziana Deering. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.